right here. Two things. High voltage. So there's a limit to how far you can go.
Well, that's right, Ed. As I mentioned before, it depends upon how paranoid you are and how bad is the situation. Again, if you're living in a very, very high lightning area and everything else is flat and you're the tallest thing within miles, you might want belt suspenders, staple gun, and all kinds of other things. But yeah, there's no guarantees in life, and that goes for lightning as well, unfortunately. Okay, once again, I am AC2GS. My name is Roy. This is the Limar Technical Net. We're here to hopefully help answer or at least discuss different concepts in amateur radio. And we're looking for anyone with amateur radio-related questions, topics, comments. So if you have one, please hit that push-to-talk button. Give us your first name and your call sign.
Roy, I have a question. WDC80.
Okay, WS2N. Okay, Ed and Paul recognize. Ed, you first.
Actually, the question was directly to you. If we want to continue on our pre-net discussion, but that'll hold. Let Paul have it.
Okay, over to you, Paul.
I'm going to get my rotator box now. There's no separate ground on this either, you know. Half a dozen wires going directly up to the Lions HD73 rotator. No ground that I see.
Yeah, I think that's kind of, you know, everything else is grounded around it. I think you just have to, if your luck is so bad that lightning escapes everything else but your rotator control cable, I think the fates are just against you.
Yeah, I agree. I've had this thing up, I guess, since the late 80s, and there's been plenty of lightning around, but I don't know. Never had a problem with the wiring going from my box to the rotator.
Yeah, I can understand it. I mean, there are guys out there who don't even ground their stations. They kind of let them float. And they've done it for 30 years, and maybe they get a little bit more static than guys who ground everything. I try to reasonably ground my system, but, you know, there are guys who just let it float.
Yeah, oh, yeah. I got my HF rig grounded, of course, but, if you think about it, if you're on an airplane, you know, you don't have a ground. Or if you're in a spacecraft, you're not connected to the ground. You'd have to have a long wire. Back to you, Roy. WS2N.
Yeah, and, you know, unfortunately, there are people, well, not necessarily unfortunately, but the people who live very, very high up in very tall skyscraper-like apartment houses, and, you know, if you figure the impedance of their ground connection, if they're going to use a cold water pipe that's running 150 feet down, the impedance of that is going to be rather dramatic. So, you know, they're, for all intents and purposes, they're floating as well.
Okay, yes. I'm just grounded to my hydronic heating system. That's the closest copper pipe to me, and it directly connects to the through the boiler system and into the main, and that's good enough.
Yeah, I would agree with you. I'm on the first floor of a kind of a raise because the basement's kind of half submerged and half above ground. So basically, it's about 15 feet from this floor to the ground. I have copper strapping going to a cold water pipe system that's buried in the ground in the backyard. It works for me.
Very good. Okay, I guess that's it for me. I just wanted to comment before you went on to the other topic that Ed was going to talk about. Back to you.
Okay, very good. So we turn back to Ed.
Oh, should I go with what we were talking about?
Yeah, if that's your pleasure, I'd be more than happy.
All right, a little background. I was talking to Andy and CDL and suggested if he's looking to do some academic studying, which he had mentioned, I said I might think he might like going for the Chebyshev filters, which I had some experience with, and I thought it might be a very interesting yet somewhat arcane subject. And Roy got wind of that and said it might not be a bad idea if I do some of that out here. Is that the story, Roy?
Yep. Unfortunately or fortunately, with software-defined radios, filter designs are going to kind of turn into algorithms rather than actual circuits. But just about everyone tonight is sitting next to a radio that has filters in them. They utilize different types of filters, Chebyshev, and elliptical, and all kind of fun filters. So I thought it would be interesting for people.
Well, let's give it a shot and see how it works. Okay?
Certainly.
All right. A number of years ago, for work, I was working on a direction-finding receiver, the Federal Aviation Administration, and many of the hams on this who are listening right now are familiar with Doppler scan DFing, and this was a fairly impressive professional one, but it had to send audio and a calculated bearing to the airport control tower that was some distance away, and they said it had to be over a standard telephone line with a 3 kilohertz bandwidth. And I was tasked with figuring out how to send both audio and data over a 3 kilohertz bandwidth to the tower. And I realized, as anybody has ever used a Doppler scan radio knows, that Doppler scanning actually puts an annoying tone on the audio. And you realize the only purpose of the audio is to confirm that your direction finding on the signal that you're listening to on another radio, so that you're not listening to one station and direction finding on another. So I realized a degradation of the audio would be a problem. It really was pretty bad, so you didn't have that much to lose. So I set up a band of audio was from 300 to 1900 hertz, and I had a guard band up to around 2500 hertz, and the top end of it was used for a fairly low digital data stream with the data. I mean, it was like 110 baud or something, so it didn't have that much bandwidth. Now here's a problem. I needed some very sharp filters to make sure that the audio and the data didn't get into each other. The data had to be clean enough that it would be decoded. Audio had enough problems, you didn't want to add the data into it, so you had to keep both separate. So that was the task. Roy, that makes sense?
Yeah, it makes perfect sense to me.
So now my next job was to figure out what kinds of filters I need. Now, let me go off on a little tangent here. I did not use, inductors and capacitors for photon audio. They were huge. But let me give an example. If you have an LC network, let's say you draw an inductor horizontally, you put in a signal on the left side, on the right side you have a capacitor ground, and you measure the voltage coming out. Depending upon the impedance, the resistances of the source and the load and the values and the frequency of the AC you're putting into this, can get a resonant peak. So you will have one frequency where you will get a rise in the voltage due to resonance. Okay, Roy?
Right.
Now, for lower frequencies, there are things called op-amps, which is an amplifier with a very, very, very high gain. It has a differential input, a plus input and a minus input, and an output. And it has very high input impedance, very low output impedance and very high gain. Now, if you try to use this as just an amp, like an RF amplifier or something, the output would just go banging from rail to rail because, you know, if one input was a microvolt more than the other one, you slam it to one side, back and forth, stuff like that. But the way these things work is you use elaborate feedback networks, so the network defines the performance. So the high input impedance, low output impedance, and high gain is almost like a theoretically perfect amplifier, you know, within limitations. And it is the resistors and capacitors around it that determine it. And you can simulate at a low enough frequency the same response with a resonant peak that you get with the inductors and capacitors. And you get an additional benefit is each, if you want to have one stage drive another, they do not affect each other. Each one stands by itself, so there's no interaction between the stages. If you're designing a big bandpass filled with coils and capacitors, and you have a batch of coils and a batch of capacitors, it is an iterative back and forth process because anything you change changes everything else. The beauty of these op-amp active filter designs, which admittedly only work at relatively low frequencies, is you get isolation. So each stage is independent from the other stage, so it's fairly simple to do the math if you want to cascade one after the other. So far, so good, Roy?
Yeah, operational amplifiers are very interesting circuits. There are ICs that do that in all kinds of fashions. There's lots of YouTubes available, so people out there interested in op amps should take a look. There's some fine YouTubes discussing their uses.
Can I add something, WHCDM?
Sure thing, Andy.
I think on those bandpass or whatever kind of filter that you want to design using op amps, you can adjust the Q of that circuit as well, which will determine the bandwidth or how wide and the shape factor of the of that filter by selecting the right components that would affect the Q of the circuit.
Absolutely, 100%. But my point is a little bit differently. By tweaking with resistors and capacitors, you can get the resonant frequency, the peak, the Q as it were. You can adjust a lot of stuff. Now, here's the problem. You don't want to run amok. You don't want to have extremely high Q, extremely high gain, because what happens is it becomes less stable and tiny variations in the component values can cause things to go crazy. So you don't want to go nuts, because then you need tolerances of the components that are ridiculous, that they're, if they're available at all, they're unaffordable. So it's a compromise between, you know, practicality and getting the most bang for the buck and stuff like that. But absolutely, Andy, you are adjusting the cue. Now, here's the point. There are different kinds of filters. A resistor and capacitor is a one-pole filter. So what happens is, in DC, if you have a resistor feeding a capacitor to ground and put in something at the resistor and you'll read the voltage at the junction between the resistor and capacitor, you'll find it at DC, it's perfect. You have the same voltage out as going in. At a very high AC value, the capacitor, in effect, short-circuits the whole thing. So you have no voltage, and there's a happy medium point, you know, the baby bear porridge bit, where it goes from flat gain and the gain starts to go off. And the frequency of that is the so-called 3 dB point, where actually half the power is getting through, which is somewhat arbitrary, but it's as good a number as any. Now, what you can also do is go to a two-pole filter, which is you double it, especially if you have an amplifier or an isolation or an emitter follower in between the two stages so there's no interaction, you can get it to drop off faster. The classic textbook will say a one-pole filter drops off at 60 dB per octave or 20 dB per decade, which is really the same thing. And two-pole filter doubles those, 12 dB per octave or 40 dB per octave. And this is a basic RC filter.
Now, repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout, cancel.
Oh. Roy?
Said you timed out the machine. Your last line was, this is a basic RF filter. Are you talking about putting the second node?
Wait a minute, are you saying when I told about one-pole filter, I was going with two-pole RC filter?
Yeah, that's when you timed out. Just when you set the line, this is a basic RF filter.
That was like half an hour ago.
Well, what can I tell you, Ed? The timeout device is the timeout device.
Can I add something?
Go ahead, Angie.
Yeah, I believe that the more poles you have, the number of orders go up. In other words, instead of it stating as far as poles, there is a filter called the first order, a second order, a third order, and so on. Depending on how many components are in that feedback network will determine the order of the filter, which will determine, again, the rest of the queue and the bandwidth and everything else.
Now, I made sure I had to be... All right, so I've reset the timing. Yes, and exactly. That is now my next point. No, I have to go back a little. Well, you didn't hear his main point. So now, if you have a resistor and capacitor, what happens is you have a flat gain up to some frequency, then it starts to lose gain. And the point where you've lost 3 dB of gain is considered the operating frequency for the filter that cuts off above that frequency. Now, let's say you take two of these and cascade them. You have an R, a C, a little emitter follower that's high input impedance, low output impedance, but you only gain, and you feed another one, you can double the drop-off rate. So you can have a drop-off after the resonant frequency at double the rate, which goes from 6 dB per octave to 12 dB per octave, an octave meaning you double the frequency. Or if you go up by 10 times, it's 20 dB or 40 dB. All right, so far so good, Roy?
Yeah, going fine.
Now, let us change the resistor to an inductor. So now we have an LC filter, but the same idea, that you have a two-pole LC filter. Well, an L and a C gives you a two-pole filter. An R and a C is one pole. You have to add another one to get up to two poles. An L and a C just... That peg is two poles, it's two active components. What you can do is do a little bit of resonance to just add a little bit of a peak. So what you can do is stretch out the flat bandpass a little and then have it go into a little bit sharper of a decline. And you can use just a touch of resonance to just tweak it to make it flat longer. Okay, Roy?
Yeah, going fine.
Can I add something?
Absolutely. Watch, she's going to say what I'm about to say next. Well, go ahead. Yeah, I love it.
No, I'm not going to. I know you like it. No, I'm just thinking. I thought when filters are measured in dB, isn't that voltage as opposed to power? Even though 3 dB is half power, and 6 dB is half voltage, I think a filter shape, as far as the skirts are concerned, is measured in voltage. How many down, dB down in voltage, which 6 dB would be half the voltage or twice the voltage, depending on which way you go. So isn't that voltage as opposed to power?
All right. That is a little bit of a tangent, but while we're here, we'll go for it. So, yes, 3 dB is half the power, 6 dB is half the voltage, but they are definitely related. They're not different. They are the same. And if you half the voltage to a load, if you take a power resistor and you connect it up to 120 volts AC, it will get hot. If you hook it up to 230 volts AC, it will not get twice as hot. It will get four times as hot. There's a square law relation, you know. P equals V square over R. P equals I square R. It's a square law relationship. And so it gets a little bit confusing with dB and voltage and power, but it really is the same thing. And my point is, I'm trying to keep this discussion away from that. Are you okay with that, Andy?
No, I understand that. No, I just wanted to just get it straight in my mind, you know, for what I remember in working with this stuff, just like you have. All right, back to you.
Yeah, but I must admit, it is counterintuitive. At first you say, wait a minute, this doesn't make sense. And it takes a while. It's more that you have to open up your mind and just go with the flow and not fight it. And eventually it does make sense. But yeah, it's not an easy task. It's very counterintuitive at first. But coming back to it. Now, what I wanted was a filter that remains flat all the way out to some point, my resonant frequency, and then I want to drop like a bomb. Now, the beauty is, if you start going into an academic study of filters, there's what's known as a Chebyshev response, which comes the closest to that ideal, where the passband is dead flat for the resonant frequency, and then it just drops. It's a so-called brick wall filter, which is a theoretical ideal. There is no such thing in reality as a brick wall filter. It's just, you know, an ideal to be approached but never quite achieved. But the best way to do it is with a Chebyshev filter, and you put a lot of poles together. Now, the problem with a Chebyshev filter is the passband is not dead flat. You have ripple, almost like you get ripple on a power supply without big enough capacitor or any linear power supply will have some ripple. If you're lucky, it's small enough you barely see it. But it's the same idea. Is the passband has ripple and is a function of the number of poles. And then I said to myself, gee, that's wonderful. How the hell do I do this? Where do I go from here? So I dug up a batch of old textbooks, and I dug back into it, and I am now going to go on to an overview of how to design the Chebyshev filter I needed. Am I doing okay, Roy?
It's fine, Ed. I'm just curious. Elliptical filters, I think, usually are designed to have a more pronounced, sharper skirt than Chebyshev's, right? I mean, they're a lot more complicated, unfortunately, but I think that they give you a sharper cutoff in the transition zone.
They're being called cover filters, the elliptical one, and they actually originate from Chebyshev filters.
I believe Paul has a deadline at 10:15, and if we're going to have any chance at all of meeting that deadline, I think I'm going to have to keep this relatively straightforward, and I think that's too much of a tangent, right?
No, it's fine. You know, I just wanted to kind of insert it just as a footnote. People can go off and Wikipedia elliptical filters and other such things. I just thought I'd just add that to the mix. I didn't want or expect you to go down two rabbit holes.
Oh, this whole subject is just rife with rabbit holes. I'm trying to avoid the rabbit holes and keep it on topic. And let's go with the main subject and need the details for future analysis. But anyway, here's the bottom line. Here's a Chebyshev filter. You start with a rather simple two-pole filter. That's pretty much the optimally flat, like I mentioned. That you bring it out flat as long as you can, and then add a little resonance to sharpen up that corner of the lamp and go down. Now that feeds a second stage that has a little bit of peaking that stretches out the final point, you know, the cutoff frequency a little. And the stage after that adds a sharper, higher Q peak a little further out that brings it out. And as you can see, the more poles you add, controlling the dimensions and the component values very carefully and using high precision components, you can get closer and closer to that brick wall filter. And the question is, how far do you have to go? On the one hand, you have to meet your design requirements. On the other hand, the more elaborate you get, the more precision components you need, the more unstable it becomes, the more the possibility the whole thing is just locked up and oscillate or something. So it's a compromise between what you want to get and practicality. Let me just let this drop. And to make a very convoluted story very short, I decided I want a 10-pole filter, get the performance I wanted with a reasonable amount of stability. The key point is that last stage, as I mentioned before, you're going to go for a fairly high Q. And you know, want it to be stable and repeatable, and the higher the Q, the harder that gets. And I found this was a good compromise. So basically it would be flat up to 1900, and then it would be down like 40 dB, you know, at 2400 hertz. And this would be the audio filter. By the way, I did the same thing in a high-pass version for the data. But it's basically the same exercise. It's just, you know, you just change the component values, and you do change the circuit rule because you're changing low-pass to high-pass. But other than that, it's pretty much the same process. So I have 5 two-pole active filter stages where I now had to work out all of the characteristics. Let me drop.
Quick question.
Go ahead.
I'm learning from this also. Isn't it true that the more poles, or the higher the order of the filter, the more the propagation delay through the filter itself occurs, which limits the upper frequency response of it?
Well, the frequency response for a low, talking about low-pass filter, you're intentionally trying to kill the high frequency response above the cutoff point. But up to it, yeah, you will have different phase propagation delays, but here's the point. We're talking about a fairly distorted audio voice signal with an annoying tone added on top of it. So, yeah, that's just one more problem among many.
Sorry, I didn't hear that part. Okay. That you're operating it as a low-pass filter because you want to cut off the noise. Okay, I got it.
No, I think you missed the key point. It's worth repeating it. I wanted to have an audio bandwidth up to 1900 hertz and then have a data bandwidth above 2400 hertz so it fits audio and very low frequency data on the same telephone line. So I have audio with a low pass filter that ideally cuts off dead at 1900 hertz, but in reality I gave it 40 dB down at 2400 hertz. And the matching high-pass filter, that's 40 dB down at 1900 hertz, up to full gain at 2400 hertz, and then relatively flat out to 300 hertz, above 3000 hertz, above that I don't care. The phone line filters that all out. You got that, Andy?
So it sounds like you're creating a notch filter that's knocking out the tone that you don't want to hear. And anything below and above that will pass. And so by putting those two filters together, that's what you're creating.
PG2RY?
Hold on, David. No, that's not what I'm trying to do at all. That noise, is the, that annoying tone is going right through. I am trying to fit an admittedly restricted audio band and some data on a carrier with an audio frequency, kind of like, you know, teletype type stuff, like, you know, two different tone type thing, in a 3,000 hertz telephone line. So I had fit voice and data on a 3,000 hertz telephone line with no interference, and I decided the audio would be distorted as little as possible to get the data through okay. Hang on, David. Is that okay, Andy?
Okay, I got that. I didn't hear that before I got it. Okay, no problem.
Yeah, I suspected that. All right, David, go ahead.
Good evening, Ed. Good evening, Andy. And good evening, everybody. Ed, I have a question for you. Would it be possible to create for each one of those signals a selective bandwidth? You know, sort of like bandwidth filter with a high end and a low end?
I'm not sure I see where you're going, of course. That could be interpreted as what I'm saying. If you're thinking of something different, you have to be more clear.
Isn't it that Chebyshev filter is exactly like that? It's elliptical and has a number of orders. You said you have 10 of them, right? And then you can manipulate between omega and Q?
Yes, Wesley, yes, absolutely. I mean, David, that sounds like what we're doing. David, do you have something else that I'm missing?
Well, you know, it started out for me in my India Charlie 718 by ICOM. We installed a IF crystal filter for single sideband, 3.3 kilohertz, just because it was known that this filter would offer better quality sounding signal, you know, maybe selectively, you know, you can, allow certain part of the signal to come through and then the other part is filtered out.
Yeah, well, you're talking about a intermediate frequency band pass filter. I don't know what the IF and the 718 is, but just for fun, let's say 9 megahertz. So you're talking about something, okay, 3.3 kilohertz wide to allow single sideband signals through at 9 megahertz. What I'm doing is at audio frequencies. These are not bandwidth. This is actually where it's at. You know, this is instead of the 9 megahertz, I'm talking like 1900 hertz. And the idea is to put two separate signals through one telephone line without them interfering with each other. But yeah, these things have an awful lot in common. Yes, they are very similar. Let me just let it drop in and I will continue. So where I was here is I said I had the 10 poles. So what I did is the first stage is a very, to use the term, blah, you know, roll off. Then the next stage has a moderate amount of peaking up to the fifth stage has a fairly sharp peak. And I was able to get it. Now, here's where the fun part comes in. Again, I was vaguely familiar with this, but now I have to have something that actually works. I need to know a whole lot of stuff. I need to know how do I analyze this? How do I confirm the performance? You know, I have to have a reasonable assumption that if I breadboard the thing, it's going to work. I'm not going to sit there tweaking it for 6 months. So, again, I'm going through the textbooks on all this, and I saw there was some fairly heavy math. And I said, okay, I am going to have to grind through this math. It's not going to be fun, but I just have to do it. I don't have a choice. And then what really said, somebody came along that really scared me, but it was totally unnecessary. Let me drop it. The math involves hyperbolic trigonometric functions. If you know what I'm talking about, sinh and cosh. Sine, hyperbolic, or cosine, hyperbolic. And the blood just drained out of my face. I never learned those. So I went off on my own tangent, started learning about using sinh and cosh, and then I realized they're just exponential terms, which I knew exactly what to do. It's like, you know, sinh of x turns out to be something like e to the x minus e to the minus x over e to the 2x. Don't look it up. I don't remember. It's just something like that. It's not germane. I don't think anybody here really cares about that. If you do, you know where to look it up. But I said, oh, I can handle that. So I cranked through it, and it really was pretty straightforward. And all the numbers were coming out. And then I first built up the low-pass filter on a breadboard, and I was pleasantly shocked. Well, you know, it actually works. Then I built the matching complementary high-pass filter at work, too. And I was very, very pleased with myself that I had gone back to the original math and worked out something, and I found it a very satisfying and educational experience. Roy?
Yeah, great. Very good. For people out there, you can find YouTube that discuss the Chebyshev filter and the Chebyshev polynomials of which they're based. There's a whole bunch of interesting YouTubes out there on the subject.
EDH with a question.
EDH?
This is WA2 Victor David Henry. My question is on the data channel. I take it that your data is centered around 2400 hertz, and I take it it is frequency shift keying at 110 baud. So you're passing everything up to 1900 for your audio and that tone, and then I take it you have something at around 2400 hertz that's FSK carrying the data. Go ahead.
Yeah, only one little tweak. The data band is from 2400 to 3000, so it's centered at, what's the average, 2700.
Yeah, I see. Okay, yeah, because I was wondering if your audio band ends at 1900, you have pretty much 1900 to 3000. More or less in the middle would be something around 2400. So that might, I was just wondering if that would give you more room for the side frequencies of the data. Go ahead.
Well, here's the story. I had to pass the audio. I had to pass the data. I had to allow a certain bandwidth to the data. And then I had to have a guard band to allow for the filter roll-off. And after going through that, it turned out I had 1900 hertz left for the audio. And I rigged up a test, and I tried listening to the audio. And the purpose of the audio is to confirm you are DFing, and the data is the angle of arrival of the signal of the station you're looking for. So the purpose is to confirm you are listening to the fellow you're talking to on the radio. This is for air traffic control purposes. And so it could be pretty lousy audio and still serve the purpose. So it was limited in bandwidth, and it had the annoying DF noise on it. So basically, it was pretty poor audio, but you can get away with pretty bad audio. So that was what it drove. I needed a bandwidth for the data, and I needed a guard band for the filters to not be ideal and perfect, you know, theoretically perfect. Does that answer your question?
Yes, perfectly. Yeah, I see. You wanted to allow the filter at 1900 some room to roll off. So you put your carrier for your data up a little higher. Yeah, that makes perfect sense. Go ahead.
KG2RY.
Hang on, David. Now, let me say, as I said, the main purpose of this is a question came up Actually, it's Andy's fault. Andy was talking about studying something, getting to understand something. And I said, you know, I once had this interesting experience with Chebyshev filters. And, you know, so that's what drove this up to present this here. That Roy and I spoke about it and thought might be good for the net. Just as an interesting example, it contains, you know, some stuff that's of some general interest, and I promised I would go into it without going too deep into the, you know, down too deep down any rabbit holes. I hope I've achieved that. All right, David, go ahead.
QSL. Well, you know, from your description, it sounds like you're trying to do some kind of equalization of the audio and the data signals, and the device type, I guess, parametric equalizer, frequency response 160 through 6,000 hertz. If it had two channels, you could put the audio through one and the data through the other. I'm not sure if that quite is equal to what you're saying, but it almost sounds a little bit like that.
No, not really. You're putting far too much sophistication on it. There was an air traffic controller in the tower who wanted to see a numeric display of the direction to the pilot he's talking to. So he wants to verify that the audio coming out is the same audio that matches the communications radio, while he sees the display of the bearing of where the hell this guy is. But meanwhile, the direction finder itself is half a mile away up on a tower. So that's where I'm coming from. And it's very, very brute force. There's no subtle sophistication. You're assuming much too much there, David.
Well, I was just describing to you what I was thinking from what you were saying. You know, I've been playing around with audio in the ham radio, and receive audio for me is very important. And this particular device was interesting me, but it's kind of expensive. You know, it's made by Bob Heil. It's called the PRAS-EQ, and then you need a speaker that has a built-in amplifier. Yeah, I think it's way overkill, like you say.
Yeah. Well, let me tell you, if you like quality audio, 1900 hertz audio with a DF tone of, in this case, 216 hertz, there's a term for that. God awful.
But for audio, audio in, audio out, you know, you control the highs, the mids, and the lows. So, you know, you can clip the lows and clip the highs and turn up the mid-range. You know, I find that ham radio audio is much easier to listen to, you know, when it's good quality, you know, especially when you want to have communications that's of ease and not of the annoyance.
Intuition.
Do we have a comment?
Intuition. I was just asking Dr. Roy, are we going to give up general science today?
There's a few people doubling with each other. Well, Wesley, you know, I mean, primarily I'd like to do amateur radio. We'll you know, I think this is coming to a close soon anyway. So, you know, we'll see. We play it by ear here.
Oh, yeah, I'm done.
Okay, Ed, then I thank you very much. I appreciated it. I think it's an interesting problem solving in general, filter design. There's a lot more to this, obviously. Like I said, you could look it up in textbooks. You could look it up in the Internet. You could look it up in YouTube. It's all rather fascinating, and those people inclined, I would suggest that they do that. And don't be frightened with hyperbolic trigonometric functions. They can be your friend as well as the regular type of trigonometric functions. One thing, Wesley, Rich wanted to ask the group a car-related question. Is it okay with you if he goes in front of you? I don't think this is going to take too much time.
You are the boss.
Okay, I thank you and appreciate that. Rich, you wanted to ask a car question among the participants out there.
I did. It's a age-old problem. How do you tell whether it's a battery going bad or it's your alternator and generator? Or generator. Go ahead.
I can try it out.
Okay, Ed?
Let me warn you guys. I have an HD with batteries, and I'm not sure how much longer I can go. If I suddenly disappear, I can go out to the car, but there will be a break. All right, here we go. I assume you're talking about an alternator. It doesn't matter if it's an alternator or a generator. All right. Lead-acid batteries are nominally 12.6 volts, fully charged, and just sitting there on the shelf. If you take a voltmeter on a fully charged car battery, 12.6 volts, you charge it. The fascinating thing is the reason why all these stuff runs off 13.8 volts. Whenever you look up a power supply for a ham rig to replace your running off the car battery, like you want to duplicate that in your house, 13.8 volts. Now, it does vary a little bit. If you want to do it ideally, you have to tweak a little the temperature. There's a fairly straightforward curve. But the idea being the lead-acid chemistry, it's perfectly happy taking whatever current it wants to charge at 13.8 volts, nominally a little bit of a tweak, and it'll just sit there perfectly happy and it will never, ever, ever overcharge. And so the key point is you need a digital voltmeter. If you're measuring the battery voltage with the engine running and you're not around 13.8 volts or so, you do not have an alternator. You have a hunk of scrap metal turning under the hood. Does that help?
It does. What I'm noticing is that I can charge up the battery, and that might last a couple of days, but I think that the battery has become very sensitive to cold weather. Does that indicate a battery that's at its end of its life, or do batteries just die and you can't charge them, or you can't do anything with them?
Sorry, it's 2HL.
I think I can help you, but let's give HL a shot.
Yeah, this is W2HL. Good evening to everybody, Richard and Ed. There's one way of also checking. If you have if your car is running, you want to find out if it's the battery or the alternator. You disconnect the battery while the car is running, and if the car continues to run, then it's the battery. If the car goes off when you disconnect the battery, then it's the alternator.
Yes, absolutely. Let me give you this point. If you have a digital voltmeter, I think you can do it without getting your hands dirty. If you don't have a digital voltmeter, that is the default. Obviously, I'm sure. Now, car batteries do go bad. I mean, if you buy a car and keep it for a long time, when you finally sell it or scrap it, you're not going to have the original battery in there. They do, it's variable, but it's almost unheard of for somebody to scrap a car to the old days with the original battery. They do fail eventually. But here's the danger. You might have a current load on the battery. Now, my experience has been, this is personal, anecdotal experience, not backed by any scientific data. Sometimes, if the battery is shot, turn off the car, fill up your gas tank or whatever, You turn the key, starts right up. You park it. Come back out in the morning, it's dead. That, to me, is a symptom of a dead battery. The danger is, if it goes dead in a few days, you may have a sneak current path that's discharging the battery. I once had that. I forget what it was, but something was drawing like an amp of current when I thought everything was shut off, and a 50-amp-hour battery will nominally go dead in 50 hours at 1 amp, which is a couple of days. And I guess that pull off the battery terminal with the engine not running and put an ammeter in there and just make sure you're not getting more than just a tiny trickle of a few milliamperes, which the car's computers need to, you know, keep their minds, if you know what I mean.
KB2HHU.
That's something I was worried about, whether something, even with everything turned off, if there wasn't something that was causing the battery to drain. I drove last week, I drove from Riverhead to Queens at 10 o'clock in the morning, so I parked the car at noon, and at 8 o'clock at night, it just turned over. I was lucky, you know, like one more crank of the key and it wasn't going to make it, but it just turned over, and I drove it all the way back out to Riverhead, parked it, and the same thing. The next morning, no battery. So I'm leaning towards that it's the battery or I have a drain somewhere on the battery. Does it sound like that to you, Ed?
Yeah, absolutely. It's definitely one or the other. The question is which one. HHU or whatever, why don't you go, and my next question after you is, how old is that battery? But HHU, go ahead.
And it's a used car, and I bought it with the battery in it, and that was a year ago.
And HHU.
Oh, keep on, guys. Hold on, Leslie. Hold on. All right. My comment to you, you have no idea how old that battery is, unless, I assume it's the age of the car. My advice to you is change the battery. Sooner or later, it's going to catch up to you. It probably is the battery. And you're going to have to change it no matter how, you know, even if it is a sneak path discharging, you're still going to have, sooner or later, have to change the battery. Better do it now when it won't let you down, you know, everybody jokes around about, you know, teenagers, you know, who have driver's license going to lover's lane, and that's the last place you want the car to not start. All right, HHU, go ahead.
Okay, KB2HHU, just to put in 2 cents on this, what mechanics usually do to test the battery, at least we do it at the auto shop at the school I work at, is they have a simple load tester device. It's usually this big thing with clamps on it. What they do with the battery to check the condition of the battery itself is they just clamp it to the battery, positive, negative, and they put a load across it, a load test. And they look at the voltmeter, and if the load test, you know, basically if the battery's not holding its voltage after a certain amount of time, it's time to replace the battery. There's like a scale on there to say how good the battery is, et cetera, et cetera. And those load testers also tell you, you know, the state of if your alternator's working, if it's charging, which is the voltmeter function. I guess what's to get it? KB2HHU.
Hold on a second. Yes, I know exactly what you're talking about. I actually have a cheap and dirty version that's sold by Harbor Freight Tools. Let me know the drop. The problem is if you have a sneak path, it might trick you. But I agree. I'm fully aware of it. I have one myself. Admittedly, it's not a professional quality one. But you could. The problem with a dead battery is the car will start for a few hours, then it goes down, and then you fail the test. Basically, the starter mode is a load test. That load test is especially good if you don't have a starter motor available. All right, Wesley, you've been waiting patiently.
KG2RY. Okay, thank you. I've heard the advice He stole the cutoff switch. Your battery is good, everything is good. You don't complain. He stole the switch. In case you're gonna have a problem and you need immediate solution, just cut off the switch. You're parking, you cut off the switch. You need to start your car, you put the switch on. And then, if you have a time, you can fix the problem. And that's it.
Okay, hold on. David, hold on. Let me make sure I have you. All right, you didn't give me an idea there, Wesley. The other station was asking. It's not a bad idea to remove the battery, one battery terminal, let it sit overnight, put the battery terminal on, and if it starts right up, you may want to investigate a lead pass. If it's dead, then you obviously have a dead battery. Here's the problem with that. When you disconnect the battery, the computer loses its memory, and the car is going to run a little weird because these computers have a learning algorithm. The computer kind of sees, in effect, how you drive and adjusts to it. And you're going to lose that. So the car may drive a little funny. It may seem a little funny. It may not run quite the same as it did yesterday. And sometimes the car radio loses its memory, and all of your push-button program stations are gone. So it's not a major problem, but it can cause some minor annoying problems. But in your case, we want to know if it's the battery or there's a sneak load. What's the idea? Just disconnect, remove a battery clamp overnight. If the car starts right up in the morning or whatever the hell it is, whatever you want to test it for, then you know it's a steep path. If it doesn't, then you know it's definitely the battery. That is a very good diagnostic test. And the annoyance of having to reprogram the radio and the car won't run quite the same and stuff like that is a small price to pay. All right, I think David's waiting. WB2EAV.
WB2EAV from KG2RY. QSL, Ed. You know, I was thinking about batteries that go dead or that go become completely depleted, especially walkie-talkie batteries, phone batteries, you know, lithium-ion batteries and other kinds of batteries, you know. And if I allow the charge in the battery to go below 1%, or go down to zero, you know, cause of that depletion, you know, the cause of a dead battery, for me, my experience is to let it go down to 0%, then for some reason the battery hardly ever performs the way it used to, at least from my experience.
Oh, that's a whole story. Back in the early days of NiCad batteries, it was discovered that if you always discharge it down to 50% and then recharge it, and then one day you ran up below 50%, it kind of had grown, it had a memory, and it wouldn't go down to 0% like it used to. But they figured out what that was, and those batteries are long since, you know, was scrapped. And now almost nobody uses NiCads anymore. The replacements don't have that problem. On the other hand, any battery can be sucked completely dry. For example, you take a car, you leave the lights on. Let's say you leave the dome light on, and the next day the battery might be dead. You're okay. But a month later, that battery's gone. You're going to have to replace it.
QSL. And one thing I learned, you know, for strange, is that radios somehow last longer on batteries if they are AA batteries, lithium preferably for radios, radio players, and even radio transmitters. I don't know why, you know, we have these other kinds of batteries that seems so susceptible to failure.